The music just stops right there. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Drive Through HR, and it is a Friday. In some places, it's already nighttime, and people are already drinking. And I'm very envious of those people. But we've still got about a half day to kind of muscle our way through. We're going to do it. We're going to focus. Got a couple hours to fight through, and then, you know, we can get to margaritas. So we've got a wonderful show in front of us, and I can't wait to kind of talk to Allison and kind of find out what's going on in her life. I want to thank everyone for listening to Drive Through HR. I appreciate you carving out some time in your busy days to listen to us. It is very much appreciated. So, Allison, do us a favor and introduce yourself. Tell the audience a little bit about you.
Sure. So I'm Allison Cruz. I am K-Force's Senior Manager of Social Media and Talent Acquisition. Yes, that's a really long title. I get it messed up sometimes. Basically what it is, I'm the head of social media, and I manage projects and programs related to social media, digital strategy, campaigns, training, social advertising, and then a few other projects that are not related to social media at all. Which I love. So one of the best parts of my job and being here on this team is that, you know, I'm able to influence projects and initiatives that have nothing to do with my actual role. So it's fun. A lot of experimenting, trying things out. My background, it's in recruitment marketing, sourcing, recruiting, digital strategy, social media. I've been in corporate RPO and now a staffing environment. And I live in a small town north of Chicago, about halfway between Chicago and Milwaukee. I work from home with my sidekick, which is a pit bull named Bocce.
Nice, very nice. So, and you've been at K-Force for how long now?
About a year and a half.
Oh, very cool. Okay, and you said you work with an RPO. If you don't mind, who'd you work with?
Aon Hewitt, prior to coming to K-Force, I was on their RPO team.
Sure, small RPO.
Yeah, we had some pretty big clients that had some pretty exciting things going on, and I like to keep an eye on my former clients and see what they're doing, because they're certainly doing some really cool stuff in our space right now, so I'm happy to see that.
So you've interacted with social for a long time now. We won't talk about age, we won't talk about weight or hair color. So we will avoid certain subjects here on the show because, you know, we're respectful. That's what we do here, Allison. We're respectful.
Very nice.
But you've been doing this for a long time, and I want to kind of get what the separation between hype. I think so many people, practitioners, have difficulty because they read articles, they'll see tweets, they'll see people speak at conferences, and all of a sudden that becomes, because a lot of people are thinking about the future and kind of and we talk about it in the present tense, but really a lot of it is future tense. So bring us back down to reality. What's working in social recruiting right now, and what's more or less more hype, more maybe in the future, but what's working today?
Well, you know, from my perspective, it's really training and empowering the individual messages that brands put out are certainly important. That's never going to go away. So as far as, like, you know, when we talk about recruitment marketing, that is getting hotter. You know, that's not going anywhere. That's actually building up speed from what I see. But what we can't forget, though, is arming the employees, like the individual employee, to use social media in a smart way for recruiting. You know, we look at the Nielsen, you know, report of, what was it, 82% of people trust what their peers say over what a brand says. So when I see something like that, I think, okay, well, what does that mean? For example, at K-Force, so what does that mean? That means that something that my team might produce, some kind of message we want to put out to the marketplace about, you know, K-Force services, versus, you know, something that maybe one of our sales professionals might put out there, people are going to trust what that individual person is saying over what I'm saying on behalf of our brand. So both are important, but it's really, like, let's not forget, as we get all swept up in these, you know, beautifully laid out employer branding strategies and recruitment marketing campaigns, those are critical, of course, and they're necessary. But let's not forget about that individual recruiter who might be brand new to our industry, who's like, oh, what the heck, I don't know what to do, so I'm just going to start spamming people because I don't know better. You know, I'm going to just be posting my jobs left and right, and I'm not going to actually act like a human online because I don't know what to do. So that's why right now, William, I'm so passionate about training, and that's something I'm really involved with right now, is creating training for our recruiters so that they do know how to act like a person online and they don't just make the mistake of, yep, I'm just going to say, I'm hiring over and over again and spam the hell out of people.
Oh, that's fantastic. So yeah. when you talk about training, is there real black and white things, or is it all gray? And I don't want to say 50 Shades of Gray because God knows it'll get us to talk about something else. But
oh, God.
Right. Sorry about that. So do you teach people right and wrong, or do you teach them here's how you should react in this situation? And you have a couple options. Like, what's the bit there? How do you teach people that?
So I think the most valuable thing I could teach somebody is just how to think critically, how to just think in today's world. So, you know, not everything is going to be black and white, and there's, you know, more than 50 shades of gray. And sorry, now you brought it up. Now I brought it up after you, so you started it. But but you know, there's so much gray area in social media, and it changes all the time. You know, I mean, just take LinkedIn for example. You know, LinkedIn will come up with, you know, some new rule or some new feature or some new product, whatever. But it's not like they're sending me a message with, Allison, we just wanted you to know that we've changed the search capabilities, and here's how you can get around that or something. You know, so I mean, you know, I want to teach people just to think critically. And if I can just get them to be thinking of things, I feel like that's a success. So, you know, I was just down in Tampa and at our headquarters, and we did a week-long, you know, advanced skills training. And I told them, I said, you know, this will be a success for me if you're just walking away thinking about this stuff. I'm not expecting you're going to, you know, walk away and be an expert at using LinkedIn and that you're just going to be this amazing, you know, person on Twitter all of a sudden. Like, that, it takes time to develop that, and it takes an investment, you know, of your time and effort. But I will feel really great about walking away from this week that you're just thinking about these things, and you're not just, oh, I'm too busy, I'm not going to think about being social savvy. So I think that's, you know, that's where I'm concentrated on. Just think for yourself. Here's how to think about some things maybe, or here's how you can get more information on that and how to talk about it. But the rest is up to them.
It's interesting because some of this is about failure, right? You try some things, mm-hmm. as an individual, and doesn't work, does work, whatever. And you fail. Inevitably, if you're trying things, you fail. So when you talk to people, especially younger people kind of coming into the profession, might not kind of understand all the different things that are going on, how do you teach them risk? So to think critically about something is fantastic, because we're not taught critical thought pretty much anywhere in either high school or middle school or even college in a lot of cases. So teaching critical thought is great. How do you teach them, or how do you give them scenarios or ways to think about risk?
Mm-hmm. So the way that I've explained that before, and actually somebody just said this to me yesterday, that, and I just thought, I loved the way that she phrased it. She, you know, she's a leader of a team, and she said, you know what, Allison, I tell people, I expect you to fail, and there's going to be a red flag if you're not failing. So I was like, that's interesting. Like, what do you mean there's a red flag if the person's not failing? Like, you think it's the other way around. And she said, no, I want them to fail, because that means they're trying new things. That means that they're learning. They're striving for mastery. You know, they're on their journey and they're trying something. I want them to have failures, because it's also going to teach them, hey, you're new here. I want you to fail so you can pick yourself back up again. You know, fail quickly, recover quickly, and move on, and don't make this mistake again. You know, and that's why it's interesting. You know, I was thinking about, like, this topic for this show, and I was thinking, well, okay, failing. So let me think about times in my career. I'm like, this is an interesting show topic, but I love it. I'm like, okay, Crystal's like, think about when you failed. I'm like, oh, my gosh, like, every week, you know, when we think of something to talk about. But, it, you know, our industry, it's all about trying things, you know, and it's all about failing. So when I'm encouraging my team, I tell them, hey, we all fail, but we need to fail so we can learn. I mean, that means we're getting out of the box and trying things. So, you know, when I'm looking back on my career and thinking about what I would talk about today, I was thinking, well, you know, those times where I've taken risks, and I'm taking a lot of risks in my career, when I've taken those risks, even when I fell flat on my face, I just don't consider that a failure. You know, I don't consider it a failure because I wouldn't, if it's done over again, I wouldn't change anything. You know, I'm glad I did that.
Do you punish yourself for not doing something? So let's say you got to an idea and you're like, wow, that's really cool. And it made you nervous and you started sweat. You're like, I'm not going to do it. And you moved on to something else. Have you ever gone back and regretted or punished yourself for not taking that risk?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, for sure. You know, times where I've looked back and I've analyzed, like, well, why? I'm pretty hard on myself. I'm very hard on myself, and like many of us. But, you know, I look back and I'm like, well, darn it, why? Why didn't I? And I think many times it comes down to fear of like, well, I was intimidated that, you know, I would look bad. Or it could be an ego thing of like, well, what if I, you know, presented this strategy of my idea to executives and they just thought I was like, I had two heads, you know, like they just thought I was crazy. Or maybe they thought I was stupid, or, you know, maybe like, oh, why did we hire this girl? Because she's just totally out there. And so I think when I look back at, well, why didn't I bring that up? You know, why didn't I just bring out that idea? Because looking back and seeing example A, B, C, that would have really worked. And maybe some of the issues we're having today would have been solved if I had, you know, really gone for my idea and implemented it. So luckily, I think that happens less and less just because I think my attitude has changed. And, you know, I've gotten a little older. I've gotten a little more experience under my belt where I'm not as intimidated. So does it still happen? Yes. I think it happened more earlier in my career.
That's interesting.
Than it does now.
And I think that maybe that's something about coming out of college, getting into a profession, not wanting to lose your job, not wanting to look bad. I think that's everything. I don't think there's gender there or any of the other mm-hmm. stuff. I think that's how we all kind of come up. We kind of come through this process of, you know, we're a little gun shy. Even when people tell us not to be gun shy, we're gun shy because we don't want to lose our job. We don't want to look bad. We don't want others to look bad. How much do you factor in what others will think of some of the things that you're doing?
You know, in my role, I do have to think about that pretty consistently. I do need to think about that because, you know, something that is important to my role now is influencing others. And some of the people that I have to influence may be more risk adverse than I am. Do you like how I put that? Very easy way to put it.
mm-hmm.
So thinking about social media, you know, thinking about that intersection with talent acquisition, I mean, there are some things that maybe I would want to try that people, the decision makers that I work with, are not ready for. They're not ready for that. So it's the whole concept, you know, that I talk about with my team. Let's crawl first. And then we'll get up and be running in marathons in no time. But there's a certain progression that makes sense. And I think that that is something I try to teach my team, and I'm trying to also learn myself quickly. And I talk to people, you know, outside of K-Force on a regular basis about this kind of thing too, because I'm trying to develop in this area of be patient with certain things. You know, I've got a ton of energy and I got a lot of ideas and I'm just like, go. But, you know, sometimes we do, it's smarter to just slow down and say, well, are we as a firm ready for this? You know, are we as a team ready for this? Are you and I ready for this? And be smart about it. You know, we don't, one of the things, you know, about conferences, I was talking about this, you know, the other day with somebody, is like, you know, I love going to conferences, but there's a little frustration there too, because when I get back, I want to do everything. You know, I want to, like, oh my gosh, in this session, they talked about this, that session, I want to go do it all. And it's just as being strategic about, okay, Allison, calm down, back it up a little bit. What can you realistically start accomplishing? You know? So Yeah, that's interesting. But I did have a failure story, if you'd like to hear it.
I would love to hear it.
Okay. So, all right. So here, I started thinking, you know, prepping for today, and I was starting to think about times in my career when I have not been effective. So I have failed somehow. I have not been effective in what I was trying to do. And I started thinking about how important interpersonal interactions, you know, relationships are in our business. So I thought of two stories that I thought I would share that I'm thinking people will relate to. The first one's about email. So like probably a lot of people, I rely heavily on using email. And sometimes it is the quickest way to get my point across. Just email it, you know, instead of picking up the phone, calling somebody, just email it out. And working from home, you know, my team is scattered across a half a dozen states. So I can't simply pop in and chat. I don't have the luxury of just stopping by, hey, William, let's just go grab some coffee. I got to talk to you about something. You know, I don't have that with the team. So we have to rely on technology. So what I've been relying on is email. And the problem with email is that you can't see someone's face. You can't hear their tone, read body language. So a single sentence could be interpreted way differently than you intend for it to. So, for example, you know, take this for example. So in the beginning of a sentence, you might say, as discussed. So like, as discussed, I'd like you to please do X, Y, Z. Or as I discussed, I don't care for that image and would like to use a different one. So it could sound just innocuous to some, like, hey, remember when we talked about that yesterday? I'm just expanding on that thought. You know, I'd like to do this, blah, 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 blah. But to others reading that same part, it could be like, listen, idiot, I already said this to you once. Why do I have to repeat myself? Don't you just remember what I already said? So just that phrase could sound really aggressive, you know, and just like I'm trying to put someone in, you know, I'm condescending and putting someone in their place. Or it could just be like, oh, yeah, this is just a follow-up or this is a continuation of something we've already talked about. You know what I mean? So that – It's challenging because to me, you know, maybe when I'm writing an email, you know, it's misinterpreted and I don't even know that it's being misinterpreted. So, you know, I manage a really awesome group of talented, funny, and creative people. We work hard, we work fast, and they're sensitive to how I feel, and we all seek each other's approval. I mean, it's just that's just the way that we are. That's our dynamic. But I didn't realize how much weight they would put into certain things I would say in an email. So, in other words, they might read between my lines even when there is nothing between my lines. And I could, you know, really put a damper on their day and not even know it just by my word choice, just by the words maybe I don't use in my email. But here's the situation. So here's the story. Last year, I was managing a brand new strategic sourcing team. Many of them were fresh out of college, and this was their first corporate job. At the same time, you know, I was reading a book because I really took this seriously. I was a new manager, so I really wanted to make sure I was mentoring them in a lot of different areas and just being the best manager I could. And I was working on my own, you know, career. So I read this book, Nice Girls Don't Get the Corner Office by Dr. Lois Frankel. And in her book, she talks about unconscious mistakes that women make that sabotage their career. So have you heard of this book before?
No, yeah. I have not heard of this. Wow.
It's interesting. And it goes through, like, I think it's 100 mistakes that women might be making and not even realize it. So, you know, apologizing too much or admitting fault when it's not even their fault or not being able to say no. I mean, all of these very stereotypical. I mean, it's not going to be true for all women or most women, whatever. Not all of them, at least. But there's probably some that even men could read this and be like, oh, yeah, you know, I definitely have that habit. I need to correct that habit or change that habit so I can be more successful and move up in my organization. So anyways, I loved the book, and it really, a lot of the points hit home for me of like, oh man, I'm doing that. So after reading that book, I was like, oh, I realized my email writing skills had taken a turn for the worse, and I was using way too many LOLs and smiley faces. So I was like, yes, I know I'm in social media, and there's a lot of these emoticons, you know, going on in social media, but writing business emails, I'm like, you know, I'm a senior manager. I am not speaking like the professional businesswoman I am. I want to be taken seriously. I want to elevate my email writing and cut out all those smiley faces and the LOLs and even some memes that I might, you know, put in my emails. So I made it a point that I'm going to make my emails more business-like. So maybe you're thinking, well, yeah, how is that a failure? That sounds pretty good. Well, let me tell you, what I failed to do is communicate with my team that I was going to be doing that. And so all of a sudden, I sounded very different in my emails to them. I was more direct. You know, I didn't use all the smiley faces that I used to be using with them. So they thought I was irritated. They thought, like, oh my gosh, we're so stressed out because we can't make Allison happy. She must really be disappointed. Maybe she doesn't even like us anymore. And they were thinking all these things, and I had no idea. I had no idea that they were thinking this. So I was failing to make those connections with them. They, you know, some of them started being like intimidated by me because they were just nervous to communicate with me over email because I was just sounding so blunt. And when I realized that, of course, I said, oh my gosh, you guys, I read this book. Geez, you know, like I totally failed here because I didn't tell you. I didn't communicate. Here's something that I'm working on. Here's why. You know, here's why. It's because I want to sound more professional in my email. It doesn't mean I'm disappointed, and it doesn't mean I'm not having as much fun because I do have fun at work. Right? It's not about that. It's just that, you know, I need to not have so many LOLs and smiley faces in my email. So that's what I'm doing. It's not about you. So that's, I don't know. Does that make sense?
Oh, it totally makes sense. How far are you in the experiment?
So how professional
are your emails right now? So if we were to
go
back
in.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Give us the middle ground. No. Give us the middle ground.
When I read my email, if it seems like I need a smiley face, I will put one in there. But, like, if I'm emailing an executive, unless I have a pretty good relationship with him or her, I won't. But with my team, you know, with people reporting to me, I'll still use memes, I'll still do this and that. But I tell you, William, I still get in trouble. I get myself in trouble because I still can sound too harsh. So this example happened 2 months ago. So, like, this whole experiment is still ongoing, and it's like I still – everyone's different, too. I mean, some people are going to be more sensitive to it than others, and that's fine because we're all humans. We're all different. That's okay, and I know I'm sensitive, too. But here's the thing. So sometimes, you know, the projects that we work on, I sit on the digital strategy team. And so, some, you know, we have to be really scrappy. We're a lean, scrappy, very tenacious team. So one of the things that we do is we'll create these campaigns where we might build a landing page, we might make an infographic, there's social media posts that go out with pictures. And anyways, what happened is we would ask for feedback. And here's another way that I have failed this year. So I'm a stickler for graphics, you know, and I just am. And I want them to be in HD. I have no tolerance for spelling and grammar errors, and I just will call things out. And so when these emails were going around, and here I am, you know, oh, I'm going to write professional emails and all this stuff, I would just let her rip. I was like, oh, well, you know, I see this and I see that. And I would give over email very detailed feedback on every single thing that I saw. So here it is, direct to the point, all sorts of screenshots and big arrows and red circles. Well, I realized one day that I was not really being asked to provide feedback as much anymore. I felt like my team was a little bit quiet around me, and I realized I was completely failing because here I am, instead of building relationships with my team, they didn't even want to ask me for feedback anymore. So it was really – it was pretty devastating for me because I'm like, oh, my gosh, like, that's the worst. That's the last thing I'd want to do is make somebody else feel bad because I know we're all trying, you know, and anybody can make a mistake. And anybody can – I mean, I make mistakes all the time. And I realized the way that I was providing my feedback over email when I was so blunt to the point was turning them off and was demotivating them, which is just – was just horrible. It was just, I was just, like, disgusted with myself. I was like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe I made them feel bad just by my dumb way of writing emails. Oh, my gosh. So I talked to my mentor about it, and I was like, yeah, this is what's going on. And he said, you know, one of my strongest traits was my high standard for quality and my attention to detail. And he said, you know, never apologize for being a yardstick of quality. That's how he put it. He's like, continue to push your team, you know, continue to encourage them, you know, keep trying. So what I realized I needed to do, and going back to your question about, like, how's the experiment going? It's still going. But what I do now is get on the phone. I mean, just talking on the phone, you know, making sure I've got a lot of positive feedback as well. Because that's the other thing, too, and I don't know if you do this sometimes, but sometimes, like, I do just critique it, but I don't talk about all the positive things I do like about it. And it just sounds very negative because I'm just like, oh, and this and this and this and this. Without saying, wow, first of all, it's really cool that you taught yourself how to make an infographic, so good job there. And wow, that's really great that you had that in there. We just get so busy that I'm just like, nope, it's this, 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 and this. Like I'm grading a paper, you know, of a fifth grader, just making somebody feel really bad about it and not intending to. So now what I do, I get on the phone, I talk to people. When I get to be in person with my team, even better. I mean, that's ideal, but, you know, just logistically, that can't happen that much. But talking to them, picking up the phone, making a point to just schedule time to just chit-chat and build those relationships, talk about stuff outside of work, that's my approach now, is just trying to be as human as I can and not just spit out my feedback. So
that all sounds good. Actually, it sounds really good. The only difficulty I have, I guess, structurally is, are you losing yourself in this process?
That is a great question. And, you know, I don't have all that figured out because, and that's why I went to my mentor about it. I was like, you know, it's just, I have a high standard of quality because guess what? I'm representing a $1 billion brand. Like I have to, and I feel this pressure like I have to, but I can't have that cost me relationships either, you know, and it can't be at the cost of someone else's feelings. So it is a struggle. It is something that I'm currently working on right now, you know, and I probably will fail at it again, you know, as much as I don't want to. Because we're dealing with people that have emotion. So it's not just so black and white. And it is, again, 50 Shades of Grey, where it's like, yes, I need to say that this graphic needs work. I need to say that is spelled wrong. But I need to say it in a way that's going to not make them feel like crap. So I'm trying to withhold my standards at the same time juggling, not demotivating someone else.
Yeah, what's interesting, I mean, it's just really compelling conversation because, you know, on some levels, is it your job to respond to their inadequacies or their job to respond to your strengths? And there is no right answer. I mean, shit, good God, who knows what the answer is. But what's interesting is you're trying a lot of different things, which I think is really amazing. And you're trying to figure out, okay, I don't want to tear them completely down. But at the same time, they've got to see with my vision. And if they can't see with my vision, then you're spending a lot of time, money, and energy around their inefficiencies. And, you know, first of all, everyone has inefficiencies, right? And especially young in one's career, they're just wrought with inefficiencies. So at a certain point, right, they either get it,
right,
they get your eye, or they have to be gone. Like they just have to move. Because you're spending, if you really calculate it in your week, a lot of time making sure that you don't come off in the wrong way, which I'm going to put an asterisk next to, because I'm not sure that that's the job. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, at a certain point, maybe some of this is generational. Maybe it's some of the folks because, you know, fair enough. There's could be a lot of other factors at play here. But if you're the beacon of quality and either over course of time they get it and then they push you to even go higher on quality, which would be great. But at the end of the day, well, you're going to have to take a day off. You're going to be on vacation. You're going to get sick, be in a car wreck, whatever. Who's managing quality at that time? who's representing your vision. And so no easy answers. I like the experiment. I do like the experiment. I like trying different things. I think you're, you know, first of all, I think just recognizing the sheer fact that you recognize they weren't coming to you and you know, probably pulling them together and go, okay, I get it. You know, I get right to the criticism part. Okay, all right, fair enough. You know what? I'll make it more palatable. But the criticism's coming. It's just gonna. It's just gonna have sugar on it. It's gonna have sugar on it. But the criticism's coming. Do you? And this would be an interesting question. Do you? Because I have liberal arts background, so I have two liberal arts degrees and a science degree. So I studied in the hard sciences, which is business, and then in the arts. In the arts, I was trained to get up in front of a class and defend my work, and also when I'm not defending my work, to critique other people's work. So for four years of my life, that's what I did: stand in front of a class, pin the thing to the wall and go, here's what we're doing, and then take it from the entire class of what's right, what's wrong, what I failed at, you know, all this stuff. And so is any of this have to do with how they come up, like how the people that have come through the system that are underneath you, how they take criticism? Is it based on age? Is it based on gender? Is it based on degrees? Is there anything that you can, because you didn't come up that way, clearly. So can you see anything in them?
You know, no. I mean, it's difficult because historically I've worked with more women either at or below my level than men. So it's I can't say it's a gender. Like, I can't really compare that because I don't have a fair representation of men. So I can't say, yeah, women just seem to be more sensitive to feedback, because that's not really fair, because I don't know that because I haven't had an equal sample size of both, right? So I can't say that. I guess I'll just leave it at that. I don't know. It's hard because it's like, yeah, we all have emotions, and I'm horrible. I mean, one of the things that, you know, that my boss told me a year ago that still kind of twinges my stomach a little bit when I think about it is that it seems difficult for you to take criticism. He said in a very kind way to me. But I tell you, William, and this is embarrassing, because he's like, it's difficult for you to take credit or adverse to criticism. Oh, gosh, I have to ask him now, how did you say that? I probably won't even remember how he said it. But he said it to me in a way where it was very, very kind. But even though he said it very kindly and gently, I teared up. And I felt like a freaking idiot, because here I am with my new boss sitting in front of him down in Tampa, and I had not even been working with him for very long, and he said that to me, and I teared up, and I'm thinking, I'm screaming to myself in my head, you freaking idiot, you're crying in front of your new boss. He can probably see that there's tears in your eyes. He's right. You're proving in real time, you're proving his point that you don't take criticism well, because you're tearing up. You know?
Oh no, I have, and seriously, we're cut from the same cloth here. So years ago, when I was running an ad agency, I had an intern, God, wonderful gal, working right next to me, literally in the desk right next to me, doing all kinds of stuff for me, and she was writing something for me. So I briefed her on it, told her what to write, and went away, and she sat at my desk, and we were in an open environment, like there were no offices. It was, you know, 50 people crammed in a room type thing. And she shows me, and I'm reading it, and her name is Kayla, and Kayla is sitting across from me, and I'm reading it, and I look at her, I'm like, what in the fuck is this? Like, no filter, you know, and I'm just like, what are you? I mean, seriously, did you take a retarded pill? Like, what the fuck? I didn't have a filter, thought everyone kind of dealt with criticism in the same way. and she started crying at my desk, and I didn't know what the fuck to do. Because I'm like, do I stop? Do I continue? Do I get a tissue? Like, what the fuck do I do? So I just kept going. I'm like, okay. she's probably embarrassed. I'm going to not acknowledge it, and I'm just going to keep moving through it. And I want to give her feedback. But I dialed back the retarded stuff, and I just said, okay, let's go through it sentence by sentence. And, you know, I worked through it. But, I mean, I you know, complete failure on my part. Because, yeah. You know, there's just a thousand different ways that I could have handled that, and I just picked all the wrong ways to handle it. And it's because of, you know, I think that people can handle criticism. If you can handle criticism, you should be able to handle it both giving and receiving, right? And so yeah. I get what your boss was saying. It's really easy for you to give and probably a little bit more difficult for you to receive, which is probably not true. But, man, I reacted. I made a lot of these mistakes because I kind of put it as a generational thing. So in my mind, wrongly probably, but I probably put it, I'm like, here, you know, I'm used to this because when I was coming up, criticism was normal. In fact, if people didn't give you criticism in the form of praise, constructive criticism, etc., then they didn't care about you. Like, that's how I came up. It's like if someone doesn't pull you aside and go, hey, that thing you did over there, that was fantastic, or that sucked, you know, then they didn't care about you. Like, they just didn't care. That's how you knew people cared about you or didn't, whether or not they told you, you know, about the work. And so I grew up that way, and then I learned, and through her and through other interns, that, you know, they do well with positive reinforcement. And not as well with constructive criticism. And I'm like, yeah, it's too one-dimensional. I can't operate in that environment. You know, if I've got to just sit there and tell you how fucking awesome you are, I fail. Because that's just not going to be the truth. So personal failure for me. I did want to get back to something you said about email and about how you get tone or how it can be misinterpreted. How do you manage not being misinterpreted in social? Because, again, like email, right? Anybody can read it with any axe to grind or whatever, or they're on whatever medications. So how do you manage that part of being either misunderstood or misinterpreted?
Oh, gosh. You can't avoid that, really. I mean, there's nuts out there that are going to be offended by anything that you would say. Or there may be there. You know, the thing is, like, when you're representing your brand, and maybe you are asking about individuals, so if you don't mind, I'll just answer for both, because I'm thinking brand, but also for individuals. So for brand, you know, you might put out something super positive, and actually this is something that happened a couple of days ago, and I won't repeat what was said because it was really nasty on Twitter, but somebody was, either they were unhappy with K-Force for some reason, or they were having a bad day, or they were just trolling. They were just going to pick out brands and, like, a sniper and just, you know, shoot at them or whatever. But we had a social ad on Twitter, and it was completely positive. You know, it was about a hiring initiative. We had career opportunities in the city. Isn't this great? And it was very positive. So it's like, that would be the most innocuous kind of safe message you could think about, because how is that going to offend somebody? It's not political. It's not anything about, you know, sex, religion, all that stuff that we're not supposed to say. No, this was like a totally neutral subject. And somebody still fired back, you know, replied to that tweet and was vulgar and said swear words in it and was acting like he was offended, you know? And it's just like, what is up your, you know what? Like, why are you badgering us? Like, we don't know you, you know, we don't have a relationship with you. You're literally just spitting fire at us for no reason. You're insane. Like, what are you doing? You know, like, you were just like, what the heck? Of course, I can't say that from, you know, our Twitter handle, but I almost want to fire back and be like, you're really strange. Like, why don't you go have a nice cup of tea and calm down? Like, I don't know why you're being so aggressive. So, you know, you can't avoid that. I mean, with a brand, especially like when you're managing a brand, that's difficult because, of course, you want to try to avoid that conflict. You want to try to avoid offending somebody. That, you know, that whole thing is fascinating to me. I mean, Crystal Miller and I, of course, you know her, we led a workshop at the Social Recruiting Strategies Conference in Boston this summer. And one of the topics we started talking about is, you know, should brands get into conversations that maybe they don't have anything to do with. So, for example, Boston Marathon bombing. You know, when that happened, there were a lot of brands that were offering their condolences. You know, brands were tweeting about, you know, our prayers and thoughts are with, you know, the families and the victims and things like that. But really, that brand had nothing to do with it. But it was just this national tragic, you know, tragic event that was happening. And it was just interesting because even talking about something like that or talking about, you know, LGBTQ issues, you know, things like that, if you're not in that space normally and it's not something you normally would talk about, I think it's a huge risk to try to get into that conversation for risk of it alienating parts of your audience, you know. So you've got the pro-LGBTQ people or advocates that would be like, yeah, that's so great. This brand is, you know, supporting us. You've got the anti-LGBTQ people, you know, that would be like, oh my gosh, why are you even talking about this? And I'm offended and I feel alienated. And, you know, social media, William, you know, we're dealing with people. I mean, people are going to be, you can't avoid it. You can't avoid offending. And I think on an individual level, same thing. I mean, of course, I try not to offend people, but I'm also not going to not share my opinions about something, you know, like if I'm pro LGBTQ, I'm going to say it. Like, I'm not going to be afraid of like, oh my gosh, am I going to alienate somebody? You know, if I feel passionately about something, I'm going to go out and say it. You know, I mean, I have a pit bull. If somebody talks bad about pit bulls, I'm going to fight back on an individual level.
Right.
So.
Well, it's the things you can do as an individual that are harder to do as brands. But in the last 3 minutes, I want to ask you a question about brands. Is it your take or your opinion that brands should, and I'm going to put you on polarities here, repulse or attract? And it sounds like an easy question, but I want to kind of paint a picture. Should we actually... The idea of repulse is to play everything that we're doing wrong, all the warts, every mistake we've made, CEOs of Lander, you know, we don't make our numbers, you know, everything that's wrong with the company, and thusly, there will be no brand drop-off. When we hire you and you get hired, you know everything. There are no secrets. There are no skeletons. Or, polarity, are we there to attract, which is generally not that type of a content. Generally speaking, it's the everything is perfect, it's Wonderland, it's amazing, it's utopia, people are perfect, and then people get hired and then find out that a lot of that isn't true. So should brands repulse or attract, and why?
I love that question. That's very good. Well, I'm more drawn to the first one. So not, and it's interesting to call it maybe repulse, but I mean, the way I think about that is self-select. So give people a very clear, authentic, transparent picture. Don't give them a lot of babble that's not true. Oh my gosh, our culture is perfect. Tra-la-la, rainbows, butterflies. Because that's not real. Like, no company is perfect. No culture is perfect. It's just not. It might be a perfect culture for that individual, which is why I like the idea of put it all out there, let somebody self-select. So, you know, let a candidate have the information that he or she needs to know so they can self-select out of it. If you're just feeding them, you know, here's this, every day is wonderful and we skip around on clouds and eat ice cream, you know, everything's great. Well, most people, first of all, can see through that. But second of all, look at your retention then. You know, someone's going to think that your culture, your opportunity, your benefits, your whatever is one way. They get in the door, they realize, oh, crap, it's not. Why did I just leave my last job? Because now this kind of sucks. And then they quit. So now you got to hire them, you know, hire somebody like that all over again. And that's just a waste. So I would go with option A, William.
Awesome. Awesome. It didn't feel like 45 minutes. This felt like a five-minute conversation. I absolutely enjoyed it. Thanks for everyone for listening to Drive Through HR. Allison Cruz, you can find her on the Twitters and the Internet. I'm sure she's on the Internet as well. It is Friday, so good news.
Yep.
Good news.
It's Friday.
Friday. Everyone have a wonderful weekend, and thanks again for listening to Drive Through HR. Thanks, Allison, for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me.
All righty.